This is Joseph L. Flatley, and you are listening to Failed State Update. This is part three of my interview with Kevin Price, former member of MOVE, a destructive cult in Philadelphia that is kind of masquerading as a radical political organization. I know this is a touchy subject, at least for me, because I'm generally a fan of radical leftist organizations. So it's kind of hard to approach this story without having feel like you're bagging on the left or social justice movements. Either way, I assure you this is not the case. And keep an eye out my Failed State Update newsletter, available at lennyflatley.substack.com, where I have an article coming out very soon about leftist political cults and how they make a mess for all of us who are worried about social change. I'm not going to ramble on too much longer. This is part three of the interview. It picks up after the police firebombing of MOVE in 1985. So make sure you listen to the other two parts. They're already in the podcast feed. Look for Failed State Update wherever you're listening to this. You will find those previous episodes. And be sure to check out Kevin's blog, Leaving MOVE 2021. There's a link in the show notes. And also check out the podcast Murder at Ryan's Run, which is a show that goes into so much more. We've even in 3 hours or whatever it's been, we've only scratched the surface on Failed State Update. So check out Murder at Ryan's Run. Check out Kevin's work. And you can hear not only Kevin's story, but you can hear about all the other people who are trying to get out of the group and get on with their lives and need your help.
I've just been advised that we have new videotape of the episode that apparently ended, we think ended, the MOVE situation tonight, the dropping of an incendiary device. And let's take a careful look at this. 5:27 p.m., state police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion. As you can see, a very dramatic explosion that occurs 30 seconds and really rips into the MOVE compound. There you see the bunker, which soon will go up in flames. And that was the explosion close up. Now, if there's anybody there, standing there, it's obvious they couldn't survive.
It's May 13th, 1985. 6 adults, 5 children perished in this firebombing incident. The world takes notice. What is the state of MOVE? Like, who survives the bombing? Who lives elsewhere and wasn't present? What does the organization look like after the smoke clears?
After the smoke clears, MOVE is... the majority of adult MOVE members are in prison. So out of prison, actually in Philadelphia, there were a couple of adult women and many children who had, you know, children who were not in the house on that day. There was a house in Chester, Pennsylvania, which is not far outside of the Philly city limits, with a few women and children. There were a few women and children in Philadelphia city limits. As far as people who were in the house after Ramona Africa survived, she was taken straight to jail and then put on trial and sent to prison, taken to the hospital first and then all of that. And Birdie Africa, who, you know, became known as Michael Moses Ward after leaving MOVE. He was a 13-year-old child, and he ended up in the custody of his father, Andino Ward. So he was no longer in MOVE after surviving on Osage Avenue. But within the prison, there were 9 MOVE members who were in prison for 30 to 100 years as a result of the August 8th, 1978 confrontation. We've discussed that. Those are the people that became known as the MOVE 9. And then there were quite a few other MOVE members in prison who started getting out of prison in the late 80s and early 90s. So Alberta Africa, who became the leader of MOVE after the bombing, she was in prison at that time. Sue Africa, Sue Lavino. She was also in prison at the time. She's like second in command under Alberta, and she is a white MOVE member. Then Carlos Perez Africa was in prison. Mo Africa was also in prison. He was the co-defendant in the federal trial with John Africa. He ended up going to prison on other charges. And there were a few other adults, Consuela Dotson Africa, and a few others other than the Move 9. So maybe around 15 people in prison, and then 4 or 5 women and a handful of children. And that was pretty much it as far as Move membership went. Then there were a number of supporters, but a lot of them kind of laid low for a while until Alberta came home in 1988. There was one other adult male, Gerald Ford Africa, Jerry Africa, and he kind of held the reins as a type of leader in Philadelphia. He wasn't in prison at the time after the bombing, but as soon as Alberta came home, they had a battle over power, and Jerry was kind of pushed out of the organization when Alberta took the reins as leader.
When you say supporters, even at this early time, it's like we explained before that a supporter is like a member of Move. It's like a different tier of membership.
Exactly. So a lot of these supporters, yeah, same categorization. A lot of these supporters were very committed and were just kind of doing what they could to support the members who were in prison, but still laying low. Most of the people in Philly after the bombing kept a significantly lower profile until the late 80s.
So who's John Gilbride, and how does he enter this story?
John Gilbride was in high school. He was a white young man at the time, growing up in the suburbs of South Jersey, southern New Jersey, not too far outside of Philadelphia, maybe a half an hour's drive outside of Philadelphia in Delran, New Jersey. He saw, just like everyone, saw the bombing of Osage Avenue on the news as a teenager.
Like 17 years old?
Yes. Yeah, 17. He would have just turned 17. And he could actually see the smoke across the Delaware River from where he was at the time. It made this huge impression on him and fundamentally shifted his entire worldview. Like, as a 17-year-old, he was a regging youth. Like, he was a young Republican, and he saw the bombing, and it from what I understand, he didn't think something like that should ever happen in the United States, right? And so, like, that event, it wasn't that he was a leftist and that Move, you know, aligned with his ideals. That event shifted what he thought America was, and he had a lot of empathy and this strong sense of justice, and he just couldn't reconcile those things, right? And so he started sneaking down to Philly while Ramona Africa was on trial. So not that long after, you know, the pretrial and all of that wouldn't have been too long after May 13th, 1985, goes to court, starts encountering Move members and Move supporters. And that deep desire for justice and empathy, and also the kind of like shock of seeing what had happened on May 13th, he is totally open. He's at the perfect age. He starts to become obsessed with Move in a way that's very familiar to me. And so he starts writing with Move members in prison, like most of us who came around did. And his family didn't really realize what was happening. He was keeping that, you know, very private. And he's spending more and more of his time thinking about Move. When he goes to college, he decides to go to Temple University in Philly. And so now he's closer. That's only less than a year and a half later. And he starts spending a lot of his time at the Move houses in in Philly. I would guess that would be sometime around 1987. And as I mentioned at the time, it was mostly women and children. Everybody else was in prison. So he's, you know, playing with the kids, taking the women shopping and helping out around the house. There weren't many men around at the time. So this young man with a car was a very valuable person to have around. So he's becoming totally brought in, ingratiated, and Move is starting to feel like family to him. While he was writing to people in prison, he started out writing to Ramona, and on visits, you know, he started going to the prison for visits and met Alberta. And I'm not sure exactly at what point she took an interest in him. But when she came home from prison in 1988, he was at the Move houses a lot as a 21-year-old at that time. And Alberta was 41 at that time. She was 20 years older. And eventually, not sure exactly what year, I can't remember off the top of my head, but not that long after she came home, they became a couple. And by the early 90s, maybe even as early as 1990, Alberta bought the house that is currently still Move headquarters on King Sessing Avenue. It's this huge Victorian twin with a lot of rooms. It was kind of perfect for Move headquarters. And John moves into that house with her. So his entire life is Move. He's married to the very top. You know, Alberta was married to John Africa. She is the obvious leader of the group. So that is how John became involved in Move, and then that really changes the trajectory of his life from there.
And he marries her, and they have a child together, and he never becomes a member. He never gets the name Africa.
Right. So he marries her. They have a child together in 1996 named Zach. John would have been 28, 29, just turned 29 around that time. And Alberta would have been 48, possibly even 49. They have a child together. And it's worth mentioning just because it kind of shows Alberta's character. Move is strongly against any kind of unnecessary medical intervention, scientific, they're against science as a whole and often even prohibit necessary medical procedures. But Zach was born through in vitro fertilization, which I've now seen in court records. And Alberta lied to everyone about that for years. Now, I obviously have no problem with in vitro fertilization myself, but it just kind of shows something about her character that was... She often bragged that it was the power of John Africa and her strength, which allowed her to get pregnant and have a child at near 50 years old.
And was there some sort of, like, I don't know if prophecy is the right word, but some sort of legend or some sort of idea that she was supposed to give birth or at a late age or something? Wasn't there? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, there certainly was. And it's tricky with anything like this with Move when it comes to prophecy. It's always hard to figure out how much of that is retrofitted after the fact, because I've seen that happen a lot.
Oh, all kinds of groups. That's very common. I mean, that's one of the functions of prophecy, is that it's a way to explain things after the fact, you know, in a figurative or metaphorical way.
Right. And so she would often say that John Africa told her that was going to happen. He also apparently told her that she was going to have a white child, even though she's, you know, a light-skinned black woman, but it would be very odd for her to naturally have a child who appears to be white. And according to many, many Move members, I don't have in court record, the in vitro thing is in court records, but according to many Move members, she sought out the white egg donor and John was white so that she would have a white child. That is probably too complicated to get into now, but a lot of value in MOVE is put on light skin and whiteness, which is very counterintuitive because the outward perception is that MOVE is a Black liberation group, which it certainly is not. But part of this supposed prophecy was that the next leader of MOVE was going to be a white man. The rationale for that being that because of the prejudice and racism in the system, if there were a white man who were the strongest MOVE member, he would be received and listened to in a way that John Africa had not been, or any person of color would not have been, and would actually be able to, you know, mingle in elite circles and kind of introduce MOVE law and MOVE's religion into the largest spheres of influence, and that that would be a more effective way to bring about the global revolution that MOVE seeks to bring about. So that it all gets very strange, but part of her having a white son, according to her, was so that MOVE would have more influence, and so that her son could eventually take over the leadership of the organization.
Our previous two discussions really focused on John Africa, John Africa's beliefs, his personality, what would make him kind of suited to take this cult leader role, charismatic leader role. But, you know, Bert jumped into that role pretty quickly, even from jail, and was able to hold things together.
Yeah, so I've been able to talk to a couple of people who were around back then who are no longer MOVE members to kind of get some sort of read for, like, who was Alberta in 1975 or 1974, you know, before she was married to John Africa but was a MOVE member. And it does seem like she had a lot of influence in MOVE as early as the late 70s, based on some documents I have, some, you know, guidelines, MOVE scriptures, where John Africa is talking about, you know, you might feel this way now, but if Alberta and I came over there, you'd be saying something different. So I think she did kind of roll with him and, you know, fulfill certain, like enforcement of power alongside him. Like, looking at it now and understanding her personality and what I understand of his personality, I don't say this lightly at all. But I think my best guess is that if Alberta had a psychological evaluation, she would be classified as a psychopath. I don't think that she has empathy. And I don't think that she, I think for her attraction to MOVE was most likely as an avenue for power. I think that she was able to see something in the potential there. That's not to say that she is not or was not a true believer, but I think that she saw something in John Africa and he saw something in her where there was an alignment. And I don't know if I would necessarily classify him that way, but I think it might be a bit more complicated about what happened with him. But with her, I think there was always a drive for power. And as soon as the opportunity presented itself, she wielded that. The fact that she had been married to John Africa and it's hard to describe how good she is at using words as weapons. And the fact that within MOVE, John Africa is viewed as God, right? That gives a certain kind of power to the person that was closest to him. And she's always able to say, well, you might think that, but I was around him more than everybody. And what the actual inner teachings are X, Y, and Z. So she was always claiming that he had actually told her something different that the other people weren't ready for, which has allowed her to pretty much say that MOVE Law is whatever she wants it to be that day.
What is the role of prophecy in the organization? Is it, you know, is that the right term for their teachings? Is Alberta someone who wields that to control the group?
Yeah, it's at first glance, prophecy doesn't seem to be all that important at first glance. And it's like, even as someone who was around MOVE, you know, for a couple of years, you might not encounter that element until you start to get closer to Alberta and Rhea or Sue, the top two people. They use prophecy very frequently, and it's certainly a means of control. The prophecies are often not fully explained and can be loosely interpreted. Just about any, you know, like I remember I was with Rhea and a few other MOVE members on September 11th of 2001, and they're like, John Africa prophesies this, da 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 da. But like, there's no specifics. Every major event they claim is something he prophesies, but they try not to get too specific, because I remember there was a very widely held belief, and nearly every adult MOVE member who was around him claimed that John Africa had prophesized that until the MOVE Nine were freed from prison, that no Philadelphia sports team would ever win a championship or World Series. And when the Philadelphia Phillies won in the World Series in 2008, all of a sudden it was that, not that he said that that would happen, that in fact he said that the Philly sports teams would only win when it was most necessary to draw attention to Philly so that there was more attention on the MOVE Nine. The whole thing was inverted, right? So that happens with some frequency, but you're not allowed to question the fact that the prophecy has changed.
I laughed when you started talking about the sports teams. You know, the book I wrote about the cult in Arizona, the guy from Pittsburgh started it, and, you know, he's the highest, most intelligent spiritual teacher on the planet, and
sure,
all his followers have to, like, you know, bow when they see him and not speak unless spoken to, and he doesn't, like, mingle with his followers. But when Pittsburgh was in the Super Bowl, you know, they, like, bought a big screen TV and had a big party at his house and invited a bunch of them over. So it's like, oh my God, yeah. What is with these people in there? They're sports teams.
Everybody needs something like that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. So Alberta's in jail. A lot of these people are in prison. So his MOVE kind of like just in a holding pattern until Alberta gets out?
In Philadelphia, yes. In Philadelphia, the main things that are happening are, you know, people taking care of might be the wrong phrase based on how the children were treated. But, you know, the people are dealing with the kids and things like that. There isn't a lot of political activity from MOVE until more people start coming home from prison. They would still have the demonstrations on the anniversaries of May 13th and August 8th. And there were still activities around the MOVE Nine, but significantly quieter than leading up to 1985. And then when Alberta comes home from prison, even for the first few years she's home, a lot of that stuff isn't really ramping up for a little while. When she first comes home.
What year is that?
1988.
Okay.
And she buys the new headquarters. She's, you know, kind of trying to make sure that the neighbors in the new neighborhood feel like MOVE is not going to be the threat that it was on Osage Avenue. She's kind of trying to rebrand MOVE a little bit, put a softer image forward than the one that she was putting forward before she went to prison. And it seems like, you know, she's also doing a lot to make John feel like a life with her, a life married to her, is going to be a viable one. Like, she's doing a lot to, I don't know, kind of groom him is the way that I would look at it now. Like, she was being significantly nicer to him than she would ever be years later. So they're doing pretty normal things for a while until other MOVE members start to come home from prison. Like, I think she was trying to make him feel like he could have a relatively somewhat comfortable, more peaceful life within MOVE. And at that time, her focus on John was love bombing. It was giving him lots of attention, making him feel special and important. And that didn't really start to change until Sue Africa, who's within MOVE known as Rhea, until she comes home from prison. I could be off by a year, but I think that was either 1991 or 1992. So John just has a very different experience of MOVE in the beginning. And then once Sue comes home from prison, they're involving themselves a lot more in the movement around U.S. political prisoners. The movement around Mumia Abu-Jamal really starts to ramp up at that time, led by Pam Africa. And then more and more people start coming home from prison. Carlos, Mo, eventually Consuela Africa. Ramona Africa comes home in 1992 as well. And so then that's when what a lot of people think of as MOVE starts to kind of reform, the demonstrations and things like that.
Again, how are they earning money? How are they feeding the kids? What's it like in MOVE for like a member or a supporter during this kind of transition phase?
John Gilbride pretty early on gets a job as a initially a baggage handler at US Air and kind of works his way up there. And he always worked a good amount. Alberta does not live the back to nature lifestyle that MOVE is known for. And Alberta likes to spend a lot of money. So John also liked to work from what I understand, but he worked quite a bit. Alberta has not had a job since the early 70s, since before she joined MOVE. But she was the trustee on an immense trust that the organization won after the bombing. And so, you know, I think I mentioned in the previous podcast possibly that she took control of the funds that were supposed to go to all of the parents who lost children in the 1985 bombing, which she did not lose a child or anyone that she had legal claims on.
So how does that happen? And how much money are we talking? Because, you know, from other places where I've read the story or heard the story, it really sounds like her, you know, what's keeping MOVE going, at least what's keeping the leaders fed and traveling, going to Paris, is this trust. It sounds like,
yeah,
you know, that's the operation, is like Alberta and Rhea have control of this trust, or Alberta has control of this trust. And then,
so the trust, if you add together the money that went to people, MOVE members who were incarcerated, who lost children, and you combine that with the money that Ramona Africa eventually won in settlement, which Alberta also took control over, it was somewhere around, I could be off by a little bit, but somewhere around $5 million if you total it all. So Alberta has, you know, she's a trustee. She's not a beneficiary, but she's able to get all of the people who are in prison to basically give her the ability to manage the money. The idea being that because they're in prison, she will be able to manage it, send the money for commissary, to pay for attorneys and all of that. You know, the attorneys were often not paid and were often not, you know, the best that could have been brought on for that kind of cash. And Alberta had no problem spending, you know, way more than your, like, the crazy thing is that, you know, for the MOVE critique of the system and your average American consumer lifestyle, she lives a lifestyle beyond, you know, most middle class Americans. So she spent a lot of that, a lot of money, but also other MOVE members don't live that way, right? So while she's doing what she does, a lot of the women who were raising the kids were doing so off of welfare money. They might work odd jobs here and there, but they're caring for kids all day and maybe getting jobs painting or doing housekeeping work. All of the men, as they came home from prison, one started a contracting business and did well, and but worked, you know, consistent 60 to 70 hours a week for decades. No one else is living off of the money the way that Alberta is. And most people actually work a lot. Like a lot of the second generation members, you know, would do construction or landscaping jobs 50 to 60 hours a week, sometimes a lot more than that.
Yeah. And who is Rhea?
So it's actually when she was almost all MOVE members, when they were underground, had a second name, and that second name becomes their underground name, becomes the inner circle name. So they have like one name they're known publicly, and then a name that people who really know them call them. So Rhea was short for Maria, which was just the name she was called when she was underground. And she is a white woman who grew up in Huntington Valley in a upper middle class, predominantly white area in the Philadelphia suburbs. She was born in, I believe, 1949. And she came around MOVE pretty early. There were actually a lot of, not a lot, but there were, you know, she's the only white MOVE member now. There were many white MOVE members in the early days. So she comes across MOVE as a, you know, 18, 19 year old, something like that, is generally dissatisfied. This is the early 1970s, and a lot of people are looking for some sort of alternative way of living. And she comes across MOVE and becomes obsessed, and pretty quickly moves into MOVE headquarters. And this is early, like MOVE was founded in 72. This may have been 73 or 74, something like that. So she's late teens, early 20s. She was the first MOVE member to give birth naturally, you know, no medication, no hospital, giving birth to her son Tommaso in a bed of straw in, I believe, like a shed in the backyard at the Palatine Village headquarters. Like she became a true believer very fast, and she was one of the most willing to go farther than everyone else. I think, you know, part of her being white and feeling like she had to really prove herself in a predominantly black organization, she was like more zealous than almost anyone. And was completely enamored with John Africa. And she was one of the people who went underground, Alberta also, in Rochester, New York, and lived in very close quarters with John Africa from 1978 up into their arrest in, I believe, 80. That was the arrest that led John Africa to the federal trial. So she was very, very close with him. And all of them who were arrested in Rochester, or almost all of them, went to prison. And so she was in prison with Alberta, and all of the women were together. But when she came home from prison, I believe that would have been in 1990, she was almost immediately like Alberta's enforcer. So Alberta is, you know, not known to anyone who is not pretty close within MOVE. Like Alberta almost stays hidden. And then Rhea is Alberta's face. So Rhea is the person who, if you're not listening to Alberta, will get in your face and scream at you, while Alberta kind of hangs back and keeps her composure most of the time. Rhea's kind of like her bulldog.
I think we have a really good sense of what MOVE is.
Sure.
After people start getting out of prison. Maybe we pick it up with John Gilbride's story. And
yeah,
how does he overlap with your story? Is he still in when you join, or...
He's still in when I am becoming obsessed with MOVE as a 14 and 15-year-old. And I was writing to MOVE when he was still in. But he leaves in 1998, and I don't become a very close supporter until 1999. So I heard whispers about him, especially like when he left, there were whispers among the supporter network. But when I was 13 or 14, I got really into punk rock, and punk rock introduced me to politics for the first time. Like, I'd never really thought of politics as something that I, as a teenager, could engage in. And, you know, going to shows and picking up zines and developing, you know, kind of rough and very abrasive and very strong opinions about things was, it was kind of, it was fun, and it made me feel engaged. And so I was really, anytime I could get my hands on a new idea, I would really explore it and try and think about, you know, how I felt about it, and became very passionate about a number of causes. And I encountered MOVE at a, I learned about MOVE at a punk rock show when I was 14. I picked up, there was a table of a group called Anti-Racist Action. And they had pamphlets about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, you know, MOVE supporter who's on, was on death row at that time, and a phenomenal journalist in his own right. And I eventually got his book. Well, actually, that same day that I was introduced to him from a flyer, I bought a copy of Live from Death Row, which is, you know, one of his first books that he published from death row. And I brought it home that night, and I did not sleep at all that night. I read the entire book from cover to cover and then went to school the next day without sleeping. And I was just, it blew my mind. His writing was very engaging. It felt approachable. He was a great storyteller. And in that book, he introduced me to MOVE, because, you know, he was a close MOVE supporter. He had a lot of stories about MOVE on the street, but in that book specifically, he was writing about the MOVE members who were in prison, the MOVE Nine.
So what is that, what is the punk rock MOVE crossover? Like, there was a time, especially in Philadelphia, where all of a sudden you're going to shows and it's like MOVE is a presence, you know, and it's like, it's a cause. How did that come about?
I think the specifics of how it came about might not even be as important as why it was bound to come about in the first place. But the specifics of it, when Ramona came home from prison in 1992, she consciously did a lot of work to make connections in the Philadelphia anarchist scene. Actually, one of the producers of the podcast that's been covering all of this, Murder at Ryan's Run, Bob Helms, was a Philadelphia anarchist who was instrumental in bringing Ramona Africa into the Philadelphia anarchist scene and setting up speaking events for her at anarchist spaces. And I think once that connection was made, you know, there's kind of a natural political alliance between MOVE and anarchists, and anarchism is the most prevalent politic within punk rock, right? So MOVE's rejection of the state and their essential call for self-governance, though that is not at all how MOVE actually functions. They talk a lot about government of self and how any man-made government is artificial and an imposition, and that very much aligns with a lot of anarchist thought. And so I think that even if there hadn't been these introductions between Ramona Africa and certain important anarchist figures, MOVE's aesthetic itself fits in so well with the world, within the world of punk rock, because like MOVE is in the early 70s, rejecting fashion, right? Rejecting any kind of like societally imposed fashion. They're wearing dirty jeans every day, work boots, you know, allowing their hair to lock naturally. They don't have beautifully maintained twisted locks. They let their hair lock, and it's intentionally kind of wild looking, right? And if you listen to MOVE rhetoric, especially in the 70s and 80s, I mean, it's just a giant F you often. Like, there's a lot of confrontation that very much vibrates at the same frequency as a lot of the anger and righteous indignation within the punk rock world. And so I think that, you know, MOVE was able to kind of see an energy within the anarchist scene, and anarchists were able to see something that felt similar within MOVE. And so just exactly as you said, like in the mid to late 90s, like most punk rock scenes that I encountered, like everybody knew about MOVE. They were kind of folk heroes, right? And so when I encountered Live from Death Row, I started, you know, the internet was in its early days, so I couldn't really find anything online. But there was, I happened across, I'm not sure if it was in Live from Death Row or if it was from a flyer that I picked up at one of the tables, but I got a hold of the P.O. box to reach MOVE in Philly. And I was living in Virginia. I grew up in Virginia. So I wrote to the P.O. box and I said, you know, I think I just put, I asked my mom to, you know, like I gave her some cash or whatever, asked her to write me a check to MOVE, to mail them a check. And just, I mean, for not a big amount, maybe $10 or $15, and asked them to send me whatever information they could about their organization. So I got back a copy of 20 Years on the MOVE, which is like at that time, the official MOVE history, you know, MOVE in their own words. And I got the book along with a Free the MOVE 9 button, immediately put the Free the MOVE 9 button on my backpack. And I read 20 Years on the MOVE almost like I was reading scripture from day one. I would hide it in my desk at school, my freshman year of high school, and just flip through the pages, wanted to know the history, the little bit of MOVE's guidelines, their scriptures that were in there, memorized some of the quotes. It was just something about, one, I had already become completely enamored with Mumia Abu-Jamal, the way that the injustice I perceived in his case and the movement around him had so much energy, and his case kind of brought together all of the issues that I was becoming very concerned with. Racism in the judicial system. You know, I was already against the death penalty, media bias, police brutality, all of these things. Mumia's case kind of brought them together very neatly. And he was a very compelling writer, is still a very compelling writer. And I really gravitated toward him. And gravitating toward him also gave this stamp of approval toward MOVE, because MOVE was not polished the way that Mumia was. And MOVE was a little bit like intimidating. Like, I remember certain alarm bells going off in my head at that time of like, is this a cult? I can actually remember having that conscious thought. But Mumia was presenting things with more nuance and was a more complex thinker, and had obviously was incredibly well-read and brilliant. And so my thought was, well, if he thinks they're legit and great, and I really like what they're saying, then, you know, maybe I should kind of not listen to that voice, and just, you know, maybe this is some sort of prejudice I have, and I'll just see what MOVE is about. And the closer I started writing to some of the people in prison, some of the MOVE 9. And once I got to know people personally, it wasn't this idea anymore. These are people I know, and they're people that I was becoming comfortable with and building relationships with. And so that assuaged a lot of those fears or the things that intimidated me about MOVE.
And what was your personal journey? You go from writing them as a high school student, you know, what takes you from there to Philadelphia to living among them?
Okay, so where I was in Virginia, where I grew up, there was a very strong chapter of Friends of MOVE, which is the MOVE supporter network. And these chapters weren't super common. So I didn't even know that there was a Friends of MOVE chapter when I first started reading about MOVE. And then I believe it was in one of the letters I got back writing to the MOVE PO box where they were like, you know, there's this chapter. And I had already encountered the people. I just didn't quite understand they were part of a MOVE supporter network. So I connected with them and I got close with them. And they're really good people, people that I'm still connected with. And I was young, you know, I was 14 when I encountered them and they were either in their early 20s or late, or, you know, early to late 20s. But I was interested in doing support work and they were doing support work. So I started going to their meetings and flyering with them and things like that. I eventually made it up to a demonstration in Philly, with them and actually like met MOVE members. And then I think the thing that really kind of sealed my fate as far as getting pulled as deeply into MOVE as I did is I ended up kind of accidentally in a romantic relationship with a MOVE supporter who was very close, who had already been around for years. And she was 6 years older than myself, like 6.5 years older. And so she was 22 and I was 16. It was a complicated relationship, but we were together for about a year and a half. And in that time, I was pulled much more deeply in because she had already been in close communication with Rhea specifically. Like she had a relationship with Rhea where she would talk to her on the phone every week for usually an hour and get advice about every aspect of her life. Like she would call Rhea to find out how she should handle situations at her job and how, like, just everything like that. She was already that deep. And once we got together, I by proxy started to form that kind of relationship with Rhea. So we split up about 2 months before I turn 18 and 2 months before I finish high school. And I was, though I didn't really intentionally find myself in the relationship, I was just, you know, I kind of a people pleaser and ended up in a situation I was in way over my head. I was still, that was my first serious relationship. I'm devastated and, you know, kind of thrown off balance. And so I'm talking to Rhea after that happens in April of 2001, when I'm still 17. And she was like, well, maybe you should just come up to Philly for the summer. Just come up to Philly for the summer. You know, that'll help you out. You'll feel better. You can staff the Office of International Concern, Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the large international Mumia support group, and just stay for, you know, two months or so, 3 months. Do some organizing work, you'll meet people, you'll have fun, and then you'll feel better. So I'm like, okay, that seems reasonable. I was, previous to getting in that relationship, I, you know, planned to go to college. At that time, I was aiming to go to Evergreen out in Olympia, Washington. Before getting so heavily involved in MOVE like that, I thought I was going to move out to the West Coast and do tree sits with Earth First and go to Evergreen. So, you know, either way, I was on a very specific path. But by the time I got in that relationship, I had kind of decided not to go to college and to, you know, do things more MOVE's way, which is kind of anti-higher education or anti-education at all, and steers people more towards jobs and manual labor. So I started learning, you know, carpentry, and I got a job, you know, in high school over the summer apprenticing on construction sites. And so I wasn't really sure what I was going to do when we split up. I certainly wasn't planning on moving to Philly, But that suggestion from Rhea was enough to move me there.
Was Rhea kind of engineering relationships and setting up situations and attracting people? Like, this is all on some level a manipulation, right?
Definitely. That relationship with the older supporter, I think, was not, to my understanding, was not orchestrated. That was kind of a happy accident for the move leadership. But everything after that point, as far as, you know, my move to Philadelphia and then many, many other events in my life after that were carefully orchestrated in order to ensure that I would stay loyal and become closer.
So, like, when you moved to Philadelphia to kind of become a full-time move supporter, what's your impression? Like, when you get there, what do they have you doing? What's it like living with the group? What's going through your mind as you kind of cross over to the next level of engagement?
Looking back now, I see things very differently, but my experience at the time that summer was like, I could not have been happier, right? I felt like I was 18. I was seeking meaning and purpose and all of that when I encountered move. And like, I had a lot to do, a lot to occupy my time. I was often staffing the office of Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu Jamal, like, I don't know, more than 40 hours a week. And that was through no pressure from anyone. I just was passionate about what I was doing and, you know, would stay there and make flyers and, you know, work on organizing demonstrations. So I was doing that, hanging out at Move headquarters a lot, helping people walk dogs, flyering for the Move 9. But there was a sense of camaraderie and purpose and structure to it that really appealed to me. I mean, I think if my politics had been different, I think I would have really enjoyed a lot of the structure and discipline of being in the military, right? It was kind of giving me a similar ability to test myself, right? To see what I was capable of. And, you know, with all of the bad that I've said, like, most of the people within Move are incredibly fun to be around and personable and interesting. And the toxicity of the structure, it takes time to understand that. And it's the people who were born into it that experience that the most. I really didn't start to butt up against that until I stopped being a true believer. And then things took a very different tone. But, you know, a lot of my time was spent doing pretty typical activist work. But the only difference was that, you know, a lot of it, final decision went to Rhea and Bert about a lot of things. But within the Mumia movement, Pam Africa has become an incredibly well-known and respected organizer because she's good at organizing and she's good at working with broad coalitions of people. And I think that she is sincere in that. And so there within Move, there are all of these kind of transitionary figures, people who are on certain borders that allow you to do things within Move that aren't quite Move orthodoxy, but that bring people in, right? So Pam is very unconventional as far as a lot of the ways that she does things aren't orthodox within Move, but because she's such a public figure and is so well respected and brings so much attention to Move, she has a lot more freedom to do things the way that she wants to do them. And because I was rolling with her a lot, you know, I was experiencing a lot of the excitement and kind of intensity of the Mumia movement at that time. And I would say that when the tone took a dramatic shift, and this brings us back to John Gilbride again, when things took a dramatic shift would be when the MOVE focus shifted from the Mumia MOVE 9 stuff to basically a campaign of character assassination against John Gilbride.
Give us a sense of the timeline. Like, you enter just as John Gilbride's kind of winding up his stay, you know, yes, in the scene. So, like, what was your first awareness of him? Like, what year was it, would you say? And what did you understand his role was in the group?
My first awareness of him probably came in late 1998, early 1999. That was when I was really starting to spend a lot of time with the MOVE supporters in Virginia. And it was at that time when John left in 1998, his son, Zach, had been born 2 years before. And for him,
his son and Alberta's,
yes,
son,
his son with Alberta. And for him, things had already taken a turn within MOVE before his son with Alberta, Zach, was born. But once Zach was born, Alberta really didn't need him the same way that she did before Zach was born. And so I've talked a bit before about meetings within MOVE essentially being, you know, to break down your ego.
Like struggle sessions almost.
That's exactly. And sometimes they can last for more than a day. That's not super common, but it does happen and wear people down psychologically, not sleeping. And once Zach was born, they were doing that to John all the time. John was being tortured and physically abused by Alberta. And so once it becomes clear to him that things aren't going to get better in MOVE, you know, he's asking other MOVE members for help. He's trying to stay married to Alberta, trying to raise his son. At a certain point, that becomes untenable. He leaves. He files for divorce. He files for custody. When that happens, he becomes an enemy beyond all enemies. So Alberta makes it very clear right away that John will never have custody or even partial custody of their son, Zach. They aren't being super open or public about what's happening yet. But sometime around late 1998, so some months after this happens, Ramona Africa will actually start to speak about the Gilbride case and start to frame it in a way that would be understandable to people in a leftist political movement who understand the history of the Black Panther Party, who understand the history of COINTELPRO. So the MOVE story becomes that John Gilbride had always been a government agent, right? That he joined MOVE, you know, as a close MOVE supporter, and married Alberta with the sole intention of having a child with her, divorcing her, filing for custody, and starting another confrontation with MOVE with the intention of causing another May 13th, 1985, so that the government could kill MOVE members. That was essentially...
I mean, talk about a long con.
That would certainly be a long con. And within MOVE, it was actually said that his father had been a government agent, special forces. I mean, they said all sorts of things. And that John was born with the sole mission of destroying MOVE, right? Even though he was born before MOVE was founded, that didn't matter.
I mean, that's absurd, but let's let that sink in a moment, because yes, it's absurd, but I think it also says something about the kind of mental state that people are in, or if, you know, the vulnerability that MOVE members have and MOVE supporters have to, you know, what Alberta's telling them and what leadership's telling them.
Yeah, and that, what I just said about him being born for that mission, was not something that was put out to peripheral people, because peripheral people would be like, would think immediately, that's insane. But peripheral people with an understanding of COINTELPRO, hearing that, you know, he married her in order to destroy the organization, that is still nuts, but it doesn't seem
it's not that
as far afield.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And they also were able to pull people in who weren't even close MOVE supporters, but were just supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the argument being that Pam Africa is the leader of the Free Mumia movement, and that what John Gilbride is trying to do with this custody case to destroy MOVE is also an attempt to destroy the Free Mumia movement, because if Pam is wrapped up in a confrontation, she won't be able to do the work for Mumia. So they were actually able to successfully pull in a lot of people who weren't even close sympathizers of MOVE, but who were just concerned about the way that this would affect the Free Mumia movement.
When does it go from Alberta, you know, slandering essentially John Gilbride to this actual campaign of harassment?
It ramps up slowly at first. So you'll see in MOVE newsletters, there be little mentions of what's happening and kind of a foreshadowing. And then by, I would say, the winter of 1999 to the new year of 2000, MOVE supporters start to be tasked with MOVE activities, right, in order to harass John Gilbride and his family. So in either late 1999 or early 2000, I and a bunch of other supporters from Virginia were sent to John Gilbride's parents' house with people driving from Philadelphia. Now, for everyone driving there, I don't want to disclose where they were living, you know, for their own privacy, but where we went for their house was more than 100-mile drive for everyone who was going there. So about 20 of us converge on their neighborhood, cover their neighborhood, every single mailbox, couple hundred mailboxes with flyers alleging that his mother is a child molester, that that he is trying to start another confrontation, that, I mean, just the worst things that you could say about people, this flyer said, and it is put in all of their neighbors' mailboxes. Were sent back a few weeks later to hold picket signs in front of the entrance to their neighborhood, making the same allegations, but even more clearly. And this is early 2000 now. There are campaigns to call U.S. Air and try and get John Gilbride fired from his job so that he won't be able to support the court costs of the custody case, which eventually bankrupted him anyway. There are harassment campaigns of flyering his neighborhood. Anyone affiliated with the custody case, the judges affiliated with the case, you know, people went out to intimidate his attorney, all sorts of stuff. Everything that you could do to a person to scare them, intimidate them. People were following him. MOVE members were following him, surveilling him. And this all takes a significantly more serious turn, as if that wasn't serious enough, August 8th of 2002. And this is about the time that I was mentioning that my focus shifted from predominantly doing work around Mumia Abu-Jamal and the MOVE 9 to being single focused on this custody case. And that's August of 2002. So I had been involved in a lot, unfortunately, I had been involved in a lot of the campaign of harassment against John Gilbride and his family. But from my perspective at the time, those were peripheral, you know, minor activities in comparison with the work to get Mumia and the MOVE 9 out, which took up most of my time. And then August 8th of 2002, Philadelphia family court judge Shelley Robbins New makes a decision that John Gilbride will be awarded partial custody, weekend visitation, holiday visits. That's it. Nothing. I mean, Alberta didn't even lose full custody. And Alberta had made it clear that John was a system person. He was no longer a MOVE person. He left MOVE. She would never trust him with her son. And so the campaign against him ramped up dramatically. And by the end of August, early September, Alberta ordered the windows at MOVE headquarters to be slatted up with you know, wooden boards, windows covered, preparing for confrontation. A banner was hung on the house saying that the custody case was a witch hunt to try to kill MOVE. We as supporters are being sent over to New Jersey to do demonstrations at City Hall and are flyering John's apartment complex, making horrible allegations against him that he's an abuser and a wife beater and all of these things to try and turn his neighbors against him and intimidate him. So things continue to intensify all throughout September of 2002. He is supposed to have a visit with his son. It's very clear that MOVE is not going to allow that to happen. MOVE was on 24-hour watch at their headquarters, you know, never leaving the house without at least half a dozen people on the roof in the front yard watching the house. They had us as supporters driving, you know, taking 24-hour-a-day shifts, surveilling the house. And basically, MOVE's position was, if you want to take Zach, you have to kill every single one of us. So the podcast series that has been covering this, Murder at Ryan's Run, goes into much more detail about all of that. But as that ramps up, there's a day when John is supposed to have a visit and officials tell him, like, you know, police tell him, you better just get out of town right now. This isn't going to happen now. So he goes, you know, for US Air, he can fly anywhere he wants. Goes to Vegas for a couple days at the police recommendation. He's just trying to sort things out, try and figure out his next approach. He's supposed to have a visit on September 27th of 2002. So he comes back into town, feels like he's being followed to the degree that, you know, in that couple of days leading up to his September 27th visit, he stays at a friend's house from work, doesn't even go back home to his apartment. And his next visit coming up is supposed to be on the 27th. He still has not had a visit with his son, you know, as the court ordered. And September 26th of 2002 is the first time he goes back to his apartment. He gets off work sometime around 11 o'clock at night at the Philly airport. He's living in Maple Shade, New Jersey, which is about a 20-minute drive from the Philly airport. It's pouring, raining that night. He drives home from work, pulls up to his apartment, and almost immediately, it seems, as soon as he pulls up to his apartment, he's ambushed and shot multiple times in the face and in the chest with what seems to have been a semi-automatic weapon with a silencer. The only reason that the police get a call is because his headlights were still on and a woman called to report that his headlights were shining in her windows. So apparently none of the neighbors with the pouring rain were able to hear, you know, the sound of his window shattering and of multiple gunshots at very close range. Like, his apartment where he was parked was, I don't know, maybe 20 feet from his apartment. And the shooter apparently was very, very close to him when the shots were fired. And so he's murdered immediately. He's dead immediately. And when the police come, based on the call about the light shining in the window, they discover, you know, him deceased in his vehicle with shell casings on the ground and no signs of anything other than that. There were no witnesses. No one really saw anything to speak of. And the case has been, you know, not much has developed by way of any official interest in the case since then. My personal feeling is that New Jersey authorities did not want to touch the case because of the political ramifications of dealing with MOVE. And ever since May 13th, 1985, pretty much every branch of government is terrified to deal with MOVE.
Do you feel that MOVE would be capable of assassinating someone, basically. And are there any rumors or suggestions that this might have happened before or since then to somebody else?
Yes, I definitely think for MOVE members, they thought that there was a very likely possibility that all of them could end up dead, right? Because MOVE is not going to back down from a confrontation. If the calculation is either John can die or myself and my kids and everyone that I love can die, you know, it becomes a lot easier to justify a horrific thing if those are the stakes and if you're not questioning that framing. Also, you know, MOVE, all adult MOVE members had spent multiple years in prison and formed very close relationships with a lot of people. I mean, I don't know who pulled the trigger that night, but it wouldn't surprise me if the person who pulled the trigger is someone that they had a connection with through their broad network of people who owed them favors, because they often looked out for people in prison.
I believe I encountered somewhere how MOVE is very active in the prison, or it might even be considered a prison gang the same way it's considered a cult outside.
So, you know, I probably went on well into the hundreds of prison visits, visiting with Mumia and members of the MOVE 9. I think classifying them as a prison gang would be it would be off. It would definitely be a mischaracterization. There's something else that happens with them in the prison. And so they have a very tight network in the prison, and people look out for them and guards look out for them. I've never heard of MOVE inflicting any kind of violence on anyone in prison. Although there certainly were some fights, especially in the earlier days of their incarceration, but that isn't the reputation that they have in the prison. They actually, from what I've seen, and this is like talking to guards and things like that, for the most part, most MOVE members in prison were considered almost model prisoners. They would mentor people, and they would, you know, because MOVE members were often imprisoned with other MOVE members, they were able to support one another in ways that a lot of prisoners didn't have support. And also they had a lot more money coming into commissary than most people. So they really looked out for people. And as a result, people looked out for them. So it wasn't so much like a prison gang situation where there's the threat of violence. It was more so that they had resources and connections with one another that made them very respected. And they also seemed to have a lot of respect from the guards. Like, the guards looked at them in many of the prisons as a force that could actually, like, kind of keep the peace, because they really weren't interested in getting into confrontations in prison for the most part, with some exceptions. But the way that they handled themselves in the prisons actually made their influence a lot greater, and it made it so that, you know, they formed alliances with a very diverse network of prisoners. Like, a lot of the, you know, Black MOVE members would listen and try and understand the perspectives of, like, members of the Aryan Nation in prison and try and find common ground and maybe try and talk them out of being in the Aryan Nation, and but would look out for them. Like, they really, I would say that actually the best version of MOVE that I encountered was the way that people handled themselves in the prison. And I always left those visits feeling really positive and upbeat. But that meant that a lot of people coming out of prison really thought the world of them and would have been able to do just about anything to protect them from potential harm.
So prison gang is a mischaracterization, but it does sound like that the MOVE as a movement or as an organization has a real robust presence in the prisons.
Yes, up until 3 years ago when the MOVE 9 started to come home, very robust. There were two MOVE members in the mid to late 70s who both died under very suspicious circumstances, and both deaths were ruled suicides but not investigated very well. One was an early MOVE member named Ted Williamson. Another was a guy named William Whitney Smith. And both of them coincidentally died right around the time when William Whitney Smith was soon to give testimony in the federal trial against Sean Africa. And for Ted Williamson, his death happened very soon after objecting to a lot of the changes in MOVE, where they were starting to publicly take up arms. And when he objected, he was, this is part of the record, he was beaten severely in MOVE headquarters to the point where his skull was fractured, and then was found dead not long after that. So those were never properly investigated, but I think they fit a pattern that is consistent with John Gilbride.
John Gilbride's family, what did they suspect happened? Did they suspect MOVE?
Yes, I don't think that they had any other thought. I mean, John's life had been threatened by Alberta and by other MOVE members a number of times. He was repeatedly told that he would never, ever get his son. And I don't think that the Gilbride family had reason to think anything else. Now, the supporter network, it's hard to describe the kind of cognitive dissonance at the time, because the murder was so connected with the custody case, but we were all also such true believers in trying to reconcile that horrific murder with the fact that it could have been done by people that we knew. I couldn't even allow my mind to go there. And so the first place where I found my mind going was, oh, they're going to try and pin this on MOVE. How do we protect MOVE from, you know, the system trying to pin this on them? And a lot of the supporters were really freaked out. Weirdly, MOVE leadership didn't seem to be worried in the slightest. And as a matter of fact, that morning, September 27th, less than 10 hours after John Gilbride's murder, all of us were called over to MOVE headquarters. All media people were called over to MOVE headquarters. There was a press conference in the front room of MOVE headquarters led by Alberta, maybe 15 journalists in attendance and about as many supporters and a lot of members. And Alberta, less than 10 hours after John's murder, proceeds to cry what even at the time made me uncomfortable, because they certainly seemed like alligator tears. But she went on to explain three mutually contradictory things. Her first was that the government killed John because she and John had actually been attempting to reconcile, and that John had recently told her that he was going to drop the custody case, rejoin MOVE, take on his role as a father in MOVE, remarry her, and that they were going to live happily ever after, and that the government hated MOVE so much that they killed John because they felt betrayed that he was abandoning his mission to rejoin MOVE. So that was the first claim that she made at that press conference. The second claim was that John Gilbride was not actually dead, and that John had faked his own death. And as we were all sitting there in MOVE headquarters, he was on his way to sit on a beach for the rest of his life, you know, in witness protection, drinking margaritas and enjoying his life, and that he faked his death so that they could pin his death on MOVE and take them down that way. And let me see, there were a couple of other claims about who killed him. At various points, the claim was that the police killed him in order to avoid confrontation with MOVE. I mean, just about any thing she could throw out there to confuse the situation, she did. That didn't sit well with me, but I still was not ready to allow myself to think that way. But the interesting thing was, there was from the perspective of a close supporter who should have felt some heat if there was a real investigation, there was very little investigation. I was quoted multiple times in newspapers. I was known to have, you know, taken part in the harassment campaign against John. And the only time I ever dealt with detectives on the case was them showing up at my job at a landscaping company where I was employed with three MOVE members and another supporter. They showed up as we were clocking out at the end of the day, informally talked to us in the parking lot, asked us if any of us were willing to come down to the station to talk. We stood in the parking lot and gave them MOVE law, which means just basically talked in rhetorical circles, you know, questioning why they were investigating this and not the false imprisonment of Mumia. Why are you investigating this and not the war crimes of George W. Bush? Anything that we could, you know, say to try and, you know, kind of put the system on trial. That's what we did for about an hour in the parking lot. They gave up and left. A few months later, a detective knocked on my door, handed me a business card. That was it. And they never followed up even years later. Like, you would think that they would think, okay, you know, some of these people may have had a change of heart. There was nothing. And there have been multiple reports from people who had things that would have been of interest, who either dropped by the police station or called the tip line and never heard, not a word back. And Philly authorities early on tried to squash any investigation to the degree that Captain Fisher, who was the head of the civil affairs unit in Philly, a couple days after John was murdered. Now, keep in mind, this isn't his jurisdiction. It's a Jersey case. He's a Philly police captain, and he's not a detective. And he gives a quote to the newspaper saying, I don't think MOVE could add anything to do with this. I know them. You know, they're not that type of people. If I was investigating this case, I would look at his gambling debts, which he manufactured out of whole cloth because John was bankrupt, but the bankruptcy was due to the custody case. I think Captain Fisher took the fact that John had returned from a trip to Las Vegas and just manufactured this claim of gambling debt and gave MOVE an alibi in the Philadelphia Inquirer within a couple days, which is really, really abnormal for that to be the position of a police department. My firm opinion is that this case was always solvable, but without Philly lending support, Jersey, a small town in New Jersey, Maple Shade is not a big police force, nor is it a big prosecutor's office in Burlington County. I think they were terrified to try and take on MOVE and essentially didn't want to solve the case.
I always ask this question. At what point did you realize you're in a cult? At what real point did you realize you had to get out?
I can't even say what the trigger was, but it was a light switch moment. It wasn't, I'm sure it was gradual, but so gradual I didn't notice. And then it wasn't gradual anymore. So my switch happened in the fall of 2007. So, you know, about 5 years after John Gilbride was murdered, I was 24 at the time. And there had been things stacking up. The cognitive dissonance was weighing heavier and heavier, but I was good at, to use MOVE speak, doing my work, which is essentially like consciously only thinking about MOVE sanctioned thoughts. And one of the things that added to the cognitive dissonance is two supporters left MOVE in 2004, and they were kind of the predecessor for the blog I'm working on now. They started a blog called antimove.blogspot.com, and I was close with them. And when they left, it was largely due to what happened to John Gilbride, and that set them spiraling and trying to figure out what MOVE was. And they were very public in leaving. So, you know, trying to grapple with what they were saying was difficult because it was so obvious, but I didn't want to, I wasn't ready to let MOVE go. So finally, 2007, I started a landscaping company with MOVE member Mike Africa Jr., who's kind of one of the figureheads now. Because we started the business, I had a lot of time to work alone. which I hadn't had before. So we're both out there. He's cutting lawns and I'm managing the landscaping part of the business. I'm often trimming bushes for hours and hours, working 60, 70 hours a week, mentally exhausted. I'm driving my work truck home one day after a long day. And I had a thought like a lightning bolt, like, oh my God, they killed John. Like it was like, I'm maybe listening to a song on the radio and singing along and like everything flipped. Like the cognitive dissonance broke. I've said before, like it felt like my brain was being rewired so fast that I could physically feel it. And I was disoriented. I was almost dizzy. And I pulled my truck over to the shoulder. It was a busy road. I like sat there stunned for a little while until I could get the wherewithal to actually turn onto a street that wasn't busy. And I just sat there and thoughts flooded my mind and all of this cognitive dissonance that was unresolved started coming together. I'm questioning the official narrative about just about everything. And I was just, it was like I'd been standing on this intellectual framework and it crumbled beneath me and I didn't have a meaning structure in my psychology anymore. Like I had no orientation and I was just confused and it was exhausting. And I also knew that if I revealed that, that I was really screwed because I couldn't show my hand. So I like sat there, I tried to collect myself, and even my wife, who previous to that, we talked about everything, I knew because she was a true believer as I had been, that if I told her any of the things I was thinking about, she would call Rhea right away and it would be a bad situation. So I tried to work things out on my own. I had one conversation with one of those former supporters that started the blog, but they didn't want to talk to me until I was fully out of move because they didn't trust that I wasn't just trying to get information from them. I had a call with the cult expert, Steve Hassan. Didn't have a lot of cash at the time, so he was nice enough to talk to me for an hour for free. And he basically said, look, like, because I was asking him, how do I do this and preserve my marriage? Like, how, like, I want to get the hell out of here. How do I do this? And he said, there are two things you can do. One is we can try and you could try and set up a situation where you can get up to New York and I could try and talk to your wife and have like a impromptu intervention. But if she wants to leave, she has to be allowed to leave. Like there's no coercion. And if that happens and it goes south, you're probably going to lose her and you're going to lose every connection you have in move. Or you can play a very long game. And he's like, I don't necessarily advise this because it's not guaranteed to work and it's going to be very difficult. And you can try to very, very, very slowly introduce these ideas and see if you can very gradually get her where you are. But that means that you're going to have to continue pretending to be a true believer. And he did not advise that, but that was the path that I chose, and I did that for 11 years. And
So what year did that start?
07. I was 24 in 2007, and my wife and I made a lot of progress, and it was gradual. So the window of acceptable critique of move opened wider and wider, but it wasn't until 2018 that we were on the same page. And there were a number of times in the intervening years where I would push things a little bit too far, she would tell move leadership and I would wind up, you know, in a meeting where they were, you know, questioning my loyalty and finding out where I stood. You know, the first time it happened was pretty early on because I was just so frustrated and pretty sloppy. And I wound up in a situation where Rhea looked me in the eye and asked me point blank, do you think we killed John? And I just couldn't lie being like face to face like that. And I said, yeah, I do. So there were a number of times like that that were incredibly nerve wracking.
So how did you end up leaving?
You know, I would say I left intellectually in 2007. And from 2007 up until now, I've put a lot of energy into trying to understand how cults function, and also into understanding kind of what attracted me in the first place. And I really have a pretty good understanding of it. But when I actually was able to publicly say that I was no longer affiliated with MOVE, that really wasn't until 2019. So my wife, her breaking point was in June of 2018, when Ramona Africa had a very easily preventable stroke and Debbie Africa came home from prison. And Debbie Africa came home from prison after 40 years and was called a traitor within MOVE because she wasn't going along with Rhea and Bert. And we were all told not to see her, which was heartbreaking because we had all put so much energy into getting her out of prison. And to us, it felt like a major betrayal by Rhea and Bert of her. And it was. And that, coupled with the fact that Ramona Africa had a stroke and then it was discovered that she had leukemia, after many of us had been trying to convince Rhea for a year to allow, or at least 6 months, to go to the doctor. It was a completely preventable situation, and Rhea was strongly discouraging her from seeking medical care and telling her that if she just did her work, that she would heal. So those two things happening at the same time served the same function for my wife, to just completely break all of the illusions in one weekend.
And bring us up today with your situation with you and your wife, and kind of...
Once my daughter was born in June of 2019, we kind of kept a low profile, and we still kept in touch with a lot of second generation MOVE members that we had close personal relationships with. Our focus transitioned, you know, to being new parents and to just trying to give as much attention to our daughter as possible. And the kind of obvious thing now happened, but at the time it was surprising how much I started to think about John Gilbride. Just as soon as my daughter was born, it's not that I didn't think about the murder of John Gilbride or who he was as a person. Previous to that, I thought about him with some frequency, but when my daughter was born, like, I was having dreams about him. I was thinking about him every day, just because I had such a visceral experience of being a new father. I didn't understand when I was 18 doing all this terrible stuff against him. I had no idea what it feels like to be a parent. And when my daughter was born, it recontextualized all of those memories. And the apartment complex where John was murdered was only a few miles from where I was living at that time. And I drove by, just in the course of my commute and other things, I drove past the entrance to that apartment complex, you know, multiple times a week. I had not pulled into that apartment complex since 2002, when we were sent there as supporters to put flyers in the mailbox against John before he was murdered. But I would drive past it and I would think about him. When my daughter was born, I'm thinking about him all the time. About a month after she was born, you know, like a lot of newborns, she had trouble sleeping sometimes. So like a lot of parents, I would put her in the car seat and drive around until I could get her to fall asleep. And actually the first time I did that as a new dad, we're just driving around, she falls asleep, but I'm just trying to keep her asleep. So I'm driving around, listening to podcasts and stuff. And I drive past Ryan's Run, which is the apartment complex. And it was, again, this visceral response. There was no intellectual stimulus. It was like my hands turned to the steering wheel. I turn into Ryan's Run. And I knew from the newspaper articles and from flyering, like, I generally knew kind of where his apartment was, his specific apartment. But I pulled in and I go to Google and I look up a newspaper article about his murder and I find out it's apartment 303. And I drive there and I pull into the parking spot, which I was fairly certain from the picture was the parking spot where he was actually murdered. And I just sat there while my daughter slept for a long time. And like, it hit me in a whole different way. And I kept finding myself doing that when I was taking my daughter out. And, you know, I was raised Catholic and John was raised Catholic. And one time I found myself praying the rosary. I felt like I needed some sort of ritual to acknowledge his life, you know? And, I mentioned it to my wife and she was just like, I understand, but it really freaks me out that you're like taking our daughter to such a, you know, just such a, it feels dark to me. Please don't do that anymore. So I didn't do that with her, but I was thinking about John all the time. So a year passes from the time my daughter's born, almost exactly a year after my daughter's born, I get a phone call, let it go to voicemail. It's a Los Angeles number I don't recognize. Listen to the voicemail. The voicemail says, "Hi, my name's Beth McNamara. I am a producer. I live in Los Angeles, and I'm working on a project about the murder of John Gilbride. I'd really appreciate it if you could give me a call." I still have the message saved on my voicemail because it just rocked my world. And I was about to take my daughter to the park. So I take her inside and I say to my wife, like, "I just got this message. Somebody is doing a project about John." And it made her uncomfortable because she knew what the ramifications of getting involved would be. But she said, "You know, you need to call her." So I took my daughter to the park. I have her in the stroller and I called Beth and we talked for probably an hour as I'm walking in the park with my daughter. And that started a series of conversations from June of 2020 that continue to present day. So she had started a project about MOVE that she thought was going to be a pretty typical, I mean, she didn't think it was going to be typical, but from my perspective, she was going to cover August 8th, 1978, May 13th. She was going to cover MOVE history. And in the process of researching that for 6 months, she learned about the murder of John Gilbride. And the fact that she had never heard about the murder of John Gilbride after researching MOVE all this time set off alarm bells in her kind of journalist intuition. And so she pivots and starts heavily researching the murder of John Gilbride. She's been doing that for quite a long time before she even calls me. And I immediately feel a moral compulsion to give her everything I have. So I have, you know, binders of flyers and letters, and I save everything. So I have every piece of paper that ever came through my hands and as a MOVE supporter. And so like, we're talking a lot and I realized soon that I am not the only close MOVE supporter or member who is talking to her, because she won't reveal to each of us who else is talking, but like, she knows way more than anybody had ever known. And she, you know, I'm telling her about meetings where there are only four other people there, and she already knows about it before I tell her. So like, it's obvious she's doing her research. She's built trust with people. So I knew it was going to be difficult involving myself in kind of speaking out about this, but what happened to John was just so horrific. And I felt a sense of obligation to his family. You know, I really participated in horrible things against his family. So I also asked Beth, "Hey, if I write a letter to the Gilbride family, can you get it to them?" So I did, got in touch with them, built a relationship with them. They're phenomenal, amazingly forgiving and lovely people. And I'm so happy to be connected to them now. But at certain points, I'm talking to Beth and she's talking to other people. I mean, she's spending 40 hours on the phone sometimes. Some weeks I'm talking to her 10, 12 hours a week at certain points. And that all leads us to March of 2021. So just 6 months ago. And 6 months ago, a young woman in her early 30s who in MOVE was known as Pixie Africa, who my wife and I have always been really close with, who now is known as June. She doesn't want to be known by her name in MOVE anymore. But for the purposes of telling this story, I'll refer to her probably as Pixie some, just because that's who she was to me at that point in time, right? But she reaches out to my wife on a on like the Telegram app, because messages can be encrypted on that app. And she was born in MOV, and she was forced to get married and have children in MOV at 12 years old. She's the daughter of Pam Africa, the head of the Mumia movement. And she had 5 children, before she was even in her mid to late 20s, but starting when she was 12. And we were unaware of what her life had actually been like in MOV. MOV leadership is very good at forcing the children to pretend like they have the best, happiest lives that a child could ever have. And we learned from her that pretty much every encounter that we had had with her when she was younger was like curated by leadership. You know, if they were sick or in pain or anything, they were told, you know, you better get out there and impress the supporters. Like, we learned that when young members were first introduced to supporters, they were told that we were CIA agents or rapists or dangerous people, that they had to convince that MOV Law, they had to convince us that MOV Law was right so that we would leave the CIA and become MOV members so that they would be safe, so that we wouldn't hurt them, right? So as I encountered them and got to know all of the young people in MOV, I had no idea that this was their experience of our relationship. But nonetheless, after at that point, almost 20 years being around, we had built a real relationship that was separate from everything in MOV. And I had that with a lot of the second generation members. So on the Telegram app, she asks my wife if she would be open to like actually talking about what her life had been like in MOV, and says, I've come to the realization in the past years that I was born into a destructive cult. And as soon as I heard that, like, I had been thinking about this for more than a decade and I had a lot of resources. So my wife said, is it okay if Kevin joins our chat too? So we start chatting and exchange pages and pages of messages. Now, June, known as Pixie at the time, is living in a MOV house, is afraid that if people understand what she's doing, that she will be killed. She had been threatened by Alberta many times, starting when she was 13 years old, that if she revealed the things that she knew about MOV, that she would be killed, her body would never be found. At times, Alberta would tell her, if you continue on the path you're on now, you're going to end up like John Gilbride. So with June, with Pixie at the time, we build a stronger relationship. We're exchanging messages all the time. At a certain point, we reveal, like, I didn't want her to feel like her trust was betrayed. And I was planning on telling her that I was participating in the podcast anyway. I had let another close supporter know. And once they found out that we were talking, he let her know that I was participating in the podcast. So she found out, and she was terrified for my safety and for my wife's safety, because she was afraid that if we came out and said that we thought Alberta killed John, that we may end up being killed. She was very, very scared about everyone involved's safety. But we continued the conversation, and it didn't take long before she said that she wanted to talk to the podcast producer of Murder at Ryan's Run. The podcast is called Murder at Ryan's Run. And so she starts talking to Beth McNamara, and we were aware, especially June was aware, of some other MOV members who felt similarly to her. But there's a big risk, because the more people that we checked in with to see how they felt, the bigger the risk that someone might go back to leadership and tell, and then all of our safety would be jeopardized.
Let me ask you one question that's kind of like in my mind right now. You mentioned that June, aka Pixie, was worried about being... So June expressed to you that she was worried about being killed if she made moves towards leaving.
Yeah.
Couple things come to mind. Like, do you think that was a realistic thing? Is that something that might have happened? Or is that something that you that's happened before?
So I think it was a realistic thing for her to believe. I'm not sure if it would have happened if she would have been discovered, but she had been physically threatened so many times, and she had seen, you know, Alberto with a gun. She had seen Alberto physically abuse many people.
And she'd been threatened, told that she was going to end up like John Kilbride.
She had been explicitly threatened.
Yeah.
And told that her body would never be found. Things like very specific threats.
So I think this goes to part of the MOVE experience that, correct me if I'm wrong, these kids often aren't born in hospitals. They don't have birth certificates.
Right.
So is there a group of children living among MOVE right now that are really just off the grid as far as like the system's concerned?
There have been, especially in the early days. Now, while almost all of the third generation kids, so like the children of June and the children of her sister and many other second generation members, almost all of them gave birth at home with no intervention, sometimes alone in a room by themselves. And so their kids, there's no record of their children, at least in the beginning. Most of them, because the second generation were born with no identification and suffered as a result of that, and it made it very hard for them to do basic life things. And they had to work hard to get social security cards and things later in life. Most of the second generation actually developed a system where within a year of their kids being born, they would, this is a strange thing, but in Pennsylvania, if you get your kid baptized, the baptism certificate can actually be enough of a proof of identification to file for a social security card. So they found a loophole where they had a friendly minister who was supportive of MOVE politically, who would allow them to do baptisms, even though MOVE is not Christian, a Christian baptism in a church. I think it was a Baptist church. And they would get a certificate of baptism, and then they could file to get a social security card. And so most of the babies born in the third generation do eventually, you know, become accounted for within the records of, you know, like social security and things like that.
Why don't you bring us up to the present day? Who's out? Who's kind of outspoken as far as former members? Have you heard from, have you got feedback from MOVE? Do you know what they think of the podcast or about you or your blog?
As June and I started, June and my wife and I really got into talking, we expanded our circle to two more members who were also interested in talking to the podcast producer, Beth McNamara. We developed a plan that we felt like the only way that it would be safe for her to escape, for June to escape, because she was the one who was most at risk for a number of reasons, and for her to escape with her children, was for them to record everything on record with the podcast and for us to make it very public. So they left July 2nd, just 2.5 months ago. We put out a press release, and I launched a blog that is leavingmove2021.blogspot.com, which is updated multiple times a week. And if you're going to start reading, try and go to the beginning and read chronologically, because it does build.
Oh yeah, I can vouch for that. It's got a progression, and yeah. You definitely want to get the grounding from the earlier posts before you go off into the unknown.
Yeah, it will take you all the way from like knowing nothing about MOVE to being an expert in you know, about 60 some posts. But so we did that, and that actually, it worked. We drew enough attention, especially within the radical political movements that support MOVE, that once most of the people who politically supported MOVE, who provided this shield that protected MOVE from criticism, once they heard the stories of just massive amounts of child abuse and other abuse that happened within MOVE, once that was understood, most of the political support that had protected MOVE has slowly shifted to supporting the survivors who are leaving MOVE. And that's been very hopeful and really just such a relief to see.